back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and as we re-enter New Camelot, I am here with my good friend, Mr. Gene Hendricks.
Yeah, let me just climb out of my fighter plane here, and we should be good to go.
Yeah. So today we're looking at issues 4 and 5 of Camelot 3000, and I said before, you know, I had read this when it was coming out, and I really enjoyed it. But I hadn't read it in quite some time, so I really don't remember all the story beats. I remember the kind of just a vague outline of what goes on. So now reading it through issue by issue, I'm really enjoying it as it's going through, because a lot of it is, even though it's not new to me, it feels new because I don't remember it all that well. So what I'm doing is I'm just reading the issues that we're covering, and I'm leaving the other ones for next time because I don't remember how the various issues resolve themselves, or even if they do resolve themselves. So I kind of want to leave that to explore as we go on. But I'll tell you right now, it is very, very tempting to just sit and read the rest of the 12 issues.
Oh, yeah, I was the same way. I was reading these two issues last night, and it was, I can't do six yet. Hold off. Because, yeah. Like we were talking about before, they all end on a cliffhanger. So you always want to go forward and see, you know, how is this going to resolve? But we must hold off for the sake of the audience.
Now, they don't have the feel of the modern writing where, you know, I'm thinking of like Why the Last Man or Walking Dead or you know, a series of that nature where they got into the mode of ending each issue on a cliffhanger. But they felt much more... I'm trying to think of a nice way to say it because I did enjoy those two series. I don't want to make it sound like I didn't like them. But each issue didn't have the weight that this series does. This series, you feel, you know, each issue is a little bit meaty. Those I really do feel those were best to read in trade because, you know, each issue would take you maybe 5 to 10 minutes to read. And you didn't feel, you know, it was like a diet meal. You didn't feel like you really got your full from it yet. So this, even though I'm anxious to go on reading it, it is definitely a little bit more of a dense read, and I'm enjoying that aspect of it too.
Oh yeah, yeah, and Bart's just continuing to do a great job with the characterizations and making each individual completely unique.
Yes, I agree. I do like that aspect of it. And I guess that is also part of the plan in limiting it to, you know, a limited round table and not going with just some, you know, crazy number of knights. Before we dive into these, is there any bit of Arthurian lore, I mean L-O-R-E, that, because I pronounced it L-A-W, any bit of Arthurian lore that you think we should touch upon before we go through these?
Not especially. Well, actually, yeah, one thing, because it's an issue 4, and I know why they did it. in this, that Gawain is introduced to Arthur, and Arthur says, refers to him as his cousin. Well, Gawain's his nephew. But I know why they didn't do it, because if they say nephew, and you don't expound on the fact that Arthur had 3 half-sisters, not just the one, then it's going to confuse people. They're going to be, oh, is he Morgan's child? No, he isn't. So it's a writing thing. I understand why he did it. It's just, when I read it, it's like, wait a second, that ain't right. What's going on here?
And do we actually get his nephew in this series? I don't remember. Well, you know what? Don't answer that, because I don't want to know.
Aha. Spoiler.
I don't remember. I honestly don't remember if we see any Modred in this, and I don't necessarily want to know.
And speaking of Mordred, Mordred is Gawain's younger brother. So he is, well, younger half-brother, since we know who Mordred's father is. But Morgan is not either one of them's parent. That's Morgoth's, the eldest sister. But again, limited number of characters. We don't want to clog it up. So that's why he didn't go that way.
Which is in some ways surprising, because he does seem to really be making an effort to be true to the Arthurian legend and not really veer off of it to make it his own. So I wonder if he would have been better off just leaving off the word cousin altogether and just leave it ambiguous.
Yeah, just call him Gawain and that's it.
Yeah, and this way you're not contradicting the Arthurian lore, but you're also not confusing the readers.
Right.
Probably would have been the better move. And if it's a misstep, it is an extremely small misstep. So I'm really not going to hold that against him.
Right. All right. Well, we dive right into issue 4 then. As we were just talking about part of it. So, Camelot 3000 issue number 4, cover date of March 1983. On sale date, December 23rd of 1982. Merry Christmas, everyone. Story, Mike W. Barr. Pencils, Brian J. Bolland. Inks, Bruce D. Patterson. Letters, John Costanza. Colors, Tatiana Wood. And your editor is Len Wein. On the cover, we have King Arthur winding up to hit one out of the park as space fighters fly at him shooting their guns. Tom can also be seen running at Arthur, presumably trying to save him. On our splash page, we have a large group of people on a view screen holding up pro-Arthur signs and chanting his name, and a hand gestures to them with a voice calling them the huddled masses. The title parchment reads, Assault on New Camelot. We pull back to see that a meeting is taking place in an office inside the United Nations. Four world leaders, or 0.44% of the heads of state, are meeting with the security director and all-around weasel, Jordan Matthew. These leaders are President Marks of the United States, Chairperson Feng, presumably of the People's Republic of China, Premier Seryov, I think I pronounced that right, of the Soviet Union, and the Supreme Rachma, presumably of some African nation. All the leaders reject the people's voices and vote to have Arthur killed. We then cut to New Camelot, with its drunken Welsh flag, meaning there's a dragon in the back with a tankard on the flag, where Lancelot introduces a new hover round table and the new knights. Gawain is dressed in classic knight's armor, complete with a green cape. Kay is dressed like a... Galahad is in his samurai armor. Tristan looks like he's dressed like a video game hero. And he corrects Arthur when called Lady. Finally, Percival enters dressed in armor with lots of pointy bits. And Kay immediately goes to attack, but Percival flings him away with little effort. Tristan stands up for Percival, and Tom's thoughts betray his fascination with Tristan's previous identity of Amber. Guinevere calls the knights to stop fighting and unite behind Arthur, to which Lancelot adds Guinevere's name, causing Kay, Gawain, and Tom to be taken aback. As Tom wonders whether Lancelot will bring down New Camelot, just as he did the historic one, we cut to Canada, where Owen McAllister broods over his loss of a bride. After smashing their wedding picture, he storms out to his car, where he's receiving a call. Jordan Matthew gives him the assignment to kill King Arthur, which McAllister gladly accepts. Back on New Camelot, the knights are about to have a toast when Merlin interrupts them with the news that they are under attack. In a two-page splash, the knights rush to the defense of their home, while Guinevere and Merlin stay behind. Lancelot, Kay, and Galahad head off to man their own fighters, while Arthur, Tom, Tristan, and Percival meet the ground troops. Tristan takes Arthur's asking him to be careful a little bit wrong. McAllister communicates with his other fighters, telling them to kill everyone but Amber, although the other pilots seem off to him. As they attack, Guinevere pulls out her communicator and tells headquarters to call off the attack. She's told, however, that there are no troops in her area. She turns down the offer of help as the fight will be over before more troops arrive. Speaking of troops, about a dozen drop down from one of the ships and are met by Gawain. He tries to talk them into an alliance against the aliens, but fails. So he pulls up a handle, which flips open, and a laser blade emerges. This is his rapier, spelled R-A-Y-P-I-E-R, because what's a fight without a little light humor? Tristan, Percival, and Tom go to help, and Tom finds out real quick that he needs more training. Luckily, air support has arrived in the form of Lancelot, Kay, and Galahad. Meanwhile, McAllister has taken aim at Arthur, who stands defiant. As the fighter comes in low, Arthur swings and adds a long fly ball. I mean, he cuts the wing off, causing McAllister to crash. Tom goes to see if there's any survivors, but McAllister pops up and points a gun at him. McAllister is shot, however, and the last thing he sees before dying is an angry Tristan holding a smoking rifle. Tom thanks Amber for saving his life, but Tristan corrects him. He didn't save Tom's life, just the life of a comrade, and the name is Tristan. The knights are joined by Guinevere, and they see that the troops they were fighting are actually aliens in disguise. Now that they're dead, they've reverted to their normal form. Arthur warns them that they need to be vigilant for enemies both within and without. As the knights cheer in celebration, we cut to Jordan Matthews watching and conferring with Morgan Le Fay, who plans to take out Merlin next. You almost hear the dun-dun-dun!
Absolutely. Yeah, I... You know, I'm happy that we're doing this two issues at a time, because I wanted to read the next issue, and at least at one point I was able to, unlike when I finished mine. So, you know, it's just building up the story more. I feel like we're getting, like, real quality story beats as far as the pacing of the tale that we're getting. You know, the art and the story itself is all top-notch. We've been discussing all along. But now I feel like, you know, first we were introduced to Arthur, then we were introduced to the knights. Now we're getting to see the knights in action, and we're getting to see the knights in action working effectively as a well-oiled machine. And then, you know, now that we're getting that, and we see them against a relatively minor threat, and doing so very efficiently, and now we're going to start to see chinks in the armor, and we'll get to that later, you know, to amp up the threat a little bit. So it really just, like, the story is hitting the beats exactly the way I'd like them to. And that's not to say that it's being predictable, because I don't think it's really that. But I think it's just, you know, it's a series of ups and downs. And I'm just enjoying the ride. It's a little bit of a roller coaster ride.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Like I said in the first episode we did, you are getting a lot of the beats that you thought you were going to get, like Lancelot and Guinevere kind of thing. And we'll go more into that in your issue, but it's like you have when Lancelot has to throw in the mention of the glorious... most glorious of all ladies, Queen Guinevere, you just see the expressions on Gawain and Kay. It's just like, oh, he didn't say it, did he? And Tom's got a thought balloon. It's like, he's going to screw this up, isn't he?
But, you know, but the funny thing is Tom is very aware of what's going on with the other people and where they're making missteps, but he's not self-aware of the mistakes he's making with Tristan.
Right. Oh, so that's just the way the teenage mind works, isn't it?
But that makes him a three-dimensional character, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not just Jiminy Cricket and the conscience of the knights. He's, you know, he's fallible himself, but he sees their mistakes. So it's just, you know, I just feel like, you know, it gives a depth to these characters, I mean, Tom obviously was not in the original Arthurian legend, so it's not a matter of his personality being portrayed in any predetermined way. But as far as I know, and my knowledge is not nearly as comprehensive as yours, but as far as I know, the knights are all being presented fairly accurately as far as their strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if you just look at them, Kay is a dick. That's the easiest way to describe him. That's his personality. And he tends to lean on the fact that he's Arthur's stepbrother really too much sometimes. Lancelot's full of himself, and so, yeah, I love her, therefore we're going to get together. I don't care about the consequences. Tristan, the interesting thing about Tristan is he was long considered the second best knight of the Round Table after Lancelot. So there's I don't remember, because it's been a few years since I've read L'Amour d'Arthur, but I don't remember him having a chip on his shoulder about that. But in this circumstance, where suddenly he's now in the body of a woman, I can see where that might also be driving.
Yeah, I don't think the chip is that he's not being respected for his prowess. I think the chip is that he is, first of all, isn't able to do the same things as a woman and has to constantly prove that he's as good in that woman's body as he was in the man's body, which is going to be difficult because I assume he's not quite as strong. And he's also got to deal even more so with the perception of others that somehow he's weaker now. Yeah. And that seems to be the really, it really, the way it's written, it feels like if everybody just accepted him as being a man, even though he's in a woman's body, all would just go well. But since they are perceiving him as a woman, it's disturbing to him because in his brain, he's not a woman.
Right. Yeah. And yeah, because like when they go out to fight, Arthur specifically calls out Tristan to be careful. And, you know, it's okay, well, why? You know, why did you say to this person to be careful, but nobody else?
And exactly.
You know, Arthur, he's stuck in a 6th century mindset. So the fact that he's even letting a woman fight should be considered a huge leap forward for him. But, you know, when you're in that situation and you want people to perceive you a certain way and they don't, it is frustrating. So I think the characterization for being 41 years old is pretty good dealing with this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Hey, Abby, just to let you know, Gene and I were interrupted just after what you heard last, and we are now picking up where we left off with this recording. So while for you only moments have passed, for us it's been 2 days. So time travel is an interesting thing. So I had a couple of little notes on this, nothing too much, but I wanted to kind of go through them with you a little bit.
Sure.
The first point is that looking at the cover, it looks to me like we are embracing a little bit more superhero fare here than we have with the first two issues. I don't know if that's a conscious effort to give the audience a feeling for where the story is going, or if it's more of a trying to pull in more a larger audience. I'm not sure which one we're looking at here.
Yeah, that's a good question, really. I mean, it's certainly got the action going. So, yeah, I can see where a broad might find that appealing. What I find interesting is the putting Tom on the cover where he is. You know, he's a really small face between Arthur's legs. It's almost we got to put him on here somewhere.
Well, I see that as giving, you know, it's almost giving a little characterization to Tom, because I think what we're looking at there is, this is, I guess he's supposed to be a late teenager, maybe like 18, 19 years old. He's in way over his head, but he doesn't know it. So he's rushing in to lend aid to Arthur, but really all he's doing is placing himself into the zone of danger and really not going to be able to offer any assistance to Arthur at all. So I think if you're reading the story, it's interesting to see his presence there. If you hadn't been reading it, I'm not sure what it does for the person who sees this on the stand.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it could give the impression that, oh, God, this guy in the armor is really nuts. Look, someone else is trying to save him.
Yeah, that's it could be. So, moving into the issue a little bit, on the splash page, front and center, pretty much, in the crowd scene, is a dude wearing an Egyptian headdress and an ankh. Do you think there's any significance to that?
I don't know. I mean, if you think about it, though, I mean, ankh is the symbol of rebirth in the Egyptian religion. So this is like, you've got people cheering, oh, King Arthur. This guy is actually saying, wow, this connects directly to my religion. Arthur has been reborn. See?
Yeah, I mean, that could be exactly that. I'm just thinking, the Egyptian headdress, I don't think you see too many people wearing that now. So I'm not sure in the year 3000 you're going to see it. But who knows? Maybe it's kind of a retro thing.
Yeah, or there's a big recent in Egyptian paganism in the year 2900, you know?
Could be. Moving into it now, I find it interesting the stereotypes they have for the world leaders, but I think that kind of speaks for itself almost. I mean, the American leader is kind of a clown with the, you know, red, white, and blue outfit and just his overall look, and whereas we're going to see a little bit of a different side of him in the next issue. And I particularly get a kick out of the, I guess, African leader. He just gives me an Idi Amin feel.
I love how he constantly refers to himself in the third person.
Yeah. Keeping moving along. Jordan Matthew. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I read this years ago. I loved it. I have the trade. I have the issues. I haven't read it in so long, I don't remember. But I just get this feeling that he's going to end up being like a reincarnated dude also. I don't know if he is or is not, but it feels that way to me. And if he isn't, I feel like it's a lost opportunity.
but the way he is drawn, I mean, this guy just exudes weasel.
Oh, yeah. No question. But I find him to be an interesting character so far, and he's definitely portrayed as a weasel that we've seen to this point. My next note is just that I found it interesting the choice of garb for the various knights. Sir Kay is basically looking like an Air Force pilot. Sir Gawain has the real old-fashioned looking armor. Sir Galahad has kind of a ninja warrior, or you know, something along those lines thing going.
Well, that's the outfit that he was introduced in.
Yes.
So he hasn't changed whatsoever.
Yeah, the other two are new choices. And then I'm a little surprised at Tristan, because he/she is wearing an outfit that's, you know, very form-fitting and almost provocative under the circumstances, and you would think she'd be wanting to wear something more manly.
Yeah, that's a possibility. It's also, I'm a little concerned because, yeah, even Kay, he's some type of padding and stuff in his jacket, whatnot. I mean, Gawain is just completely armored up. Tristan doesn't have any armor whatsoever, to the point where, you know, he's got bare arms. So, yeah. It's... I have to wonder if that's a choice. I mean, obviously it's an artistic choice to say, yes, look at this female form, which Axel approves of. But I'm wondering if it's more of a swordsman thing, you know, someone who doesn't want to get weighed down by all this armor. Yeah, it's, you know, just some, you know, there no sleeves, so nothing can get caught in the swing. Tight pants to make sure that you're not tripping over anything. So I can see a justification for it. It's just a little worrying for someone who's used to wearing armor.
Yeah, that's kind of my thoughts. Also, somebody who is so conscious of not wanting to be viewed as a woman, to dress in, you know, a somewhat sexy outfit.
Yeah, you would think, if anything, he would have picked something exactly like Gawain has. Because all you see of Gawain is his face.
Yeah.
And everything else, you could be any shape under there as long as you fit in the armor.
Interesting that Kay is the one that confronts Percival, considering that Kay is kind of a coward to begin with.
He's a coward, but he's also, like I said before, a dick. So
okay, true.
He's already not happy with Tristan, because he doesn't want to, even though we know for a fact that Guinevere and Lancelot have their memories of their historic persona and their current incarnation. So, like, Guinevere remembers everything Joan Acton remembered. So, is this... I'm wondering where this is coming from. Is this Kay acting like this? Or is this who he was reincarnated as influencing it?
And the thought has got to be, in my mind, that the thought's got to be that the person they were reincarnated as is still them. So that persona is just being... It's almost like, in my mind, say Sir Acton or Commander Acton or whatever, Captain Acton. whatever it is.
Yeah.
She is the reincarnated Guinevere, but I don't view her as being a different person who is then taken over by Guinevere's spirit. Right. I view her as somebody who is Guinevere. She just doesn't know it until her memories are reawakened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it seems to be playing. So, you know, there is the potential for a progression to each of these characters in the time since the round table concluded, the original round table, and the time that they were reincarnated, or the time that they got their memories, rather, because they did live however much of a lifetime without those memories.
Right.
So it could be, you know, this is what Kay has morphed into somehow.
Yeah. He's not a pleasant person, regardless of what source material you're looking at, you know?
Yeah. So, I guess I guess that's is that what's it called? Axel?
That's German Shepherd for get on with it.
Yeah, I do like the whole what I don't even remember what his name is that what you call it, Tristan's former fiance, you know, him being brought into the fray, and ultimately her being the one to take him out, or him being the one to take him out, with no problem whatsoever. But that does seem to have a little bit of a conflict if Tristan in the reincarnated form without the memories had cared enough about him to be marrying him and shed a tear when that broke up, the fact that she takes him out or he takes him out with such extreme prejudice just seems to be slightly out of character.
Yeah, I can make the argument that it's in battle. You know, it's okay, this is someone who's accepting me as a knight versus someone who wants to make me stay in the kitchen all day. So I have to choose one, and you know, it's okay, this is the guy on my side. You attack me, I'm shooting you. So, you know, but you would think there would be a little emotion there at the end.
Yeah.
You know, just like at the end of the wedding. You know, when the wedding broke up, yeah, Tristan was upset by it. You would think that he would be upset again here, unless mentally he's just in the I need to prove myself mode regardless, and everything else has fallen away.
Yeah. So now my last thought is that we end off with Morgan Le Fay revealing that her plan is to separate them from Merlin, because to defeat them without Merlin's help will be easy. Mm-hmm. And I guess we're going to see that as we go on, but we don't see it right away. I'm in my mind, I'm thinking about the layers underneath what's going on. You know, what is Merlin aware of? What does he know that she's going to do? What's going to happen? Again, it's been a long enough since I read this that I have no memory of the layout and how it goes. So I'm looking forward to kind of seeing what her plan is to either take him out or imprison him or do whatever to him, and what he's aware of and what his defenses he's going to have to that. So it's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, yeah, because you have two extremely powerful, extremely intelligent wizards going against each other. So it's both of them have plans within plans.
So well, and she basically admits that he's stronger than her, though. Or
right.
More powerful than her. So it is going to be interesting to see what her plan is to combat that.
Yeah, well, previously, she had followers of her own, yes, but she never had an entire planet's worth of minions like she does now. You know, she is essentially the ruler of Planet 10, so she has a little more cannon fodder she can throw out.
Yeah, and it's exactly the way they're treated in this issue when they're defeated. They're just cannon fodder thrown out there for the knights to take out. And I can only think that the strategy wasn't so much to defeat them then. I mean, if it happened, it would have been great. But more or less just to kind of test the perimeter a little bit, you know, push the fence and see if there's a weakness there.
Yeah, yeah. How do they interact? What's her next method of infiltrating them? Because right now it's, you know, they seem to be united, they seem to be able to take care of a fairly sizable force, so she's got to change tactics.
Yeah, so that's all my notes on this. I don't know if you have anything else.
Not really, just everything we've already covered. I like how they have Gwen try and reason with the soldiers he doesn't know are aliens yet. Before he even draws a weapon, he tries to tell them, hey, you know, where we should be on the same side. He deflects all their blasts and, okay, fine. You want to fight? You're going to die.
I also like the fact that he's wearing the very old-fashioned armor, but that his weaponry is modern. Or,
yes.
You know, ultra-modern, beyond what we can do now.
Yeah, he's got a light shield and a lightsaber that he attacks with.
So I think that's pretty cool. So that's it, and I'm gonna make it really, really quick and let you just run with the ball. I'm gonna say, for me, A's all around on this book.
I am right there with you. I mean, this is a great setup issue. You know, it continues some of the story, but it's like, hey, you know, okay, now the big conflict is happening. We got the band back together. Now we got to fight with them, and the art, the story, everything. Yeah, it's a straight A book.
Yeah, I think so. So moving on to issue number 5, which has a cover date of April of 1983 and has the same creative team as the previous book, so I'm not going to reiterate that. The cover shows Morgan Le Fay in her chambers, sitting on her throne, cuddling with a monkey-looking demon at her side. Her crystal ball shows Arthur, Guinevere, and Lancelot within it, looking as if they are trapped inside of it. They almost look like the negative, the Phantom Zone villains in Superman 2.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
So this is Chapter 5, The Tale of Morgan Le Fay. It opens on New Camelot, where Arthur encourages the knights to celebrate their initial victory, which is met with mixed responses from the knights. So Kay decides that it's a good time to go to Sir Tristan and poke the bear by offering a less manly cocktail dress, which incites Tristan, who is ready to give him a beating, but is stopped by Neoman, transformed Sir Percival. Arthur dismisses the knights, but he has Kay stay behind. We then see that the entire scene has been watched by Jordan Matheson, the UN director, who is collaborating with Morgan Le Fay. Matheson is unimpressed by the knights in light of their bickering, but Morgan warns him not to underestimate Arthur. Fascinated by the crystal ball, Matheson asks to look in on President Marx, and so they look in on a virtual meeting of the world leaders, who agree to cooperate with Matheson until they can usurp his power for themselves. That meeting concludes when a grenade is tossed into Marx's office, and he casually prepares to defend himself. Back to Matheson and Morgan, where Matheson tries to get a bit amorous and puts his hand on Morgan's back and is immediately grossed out, and it's revealed that her back, which is covered by a cape, is covered with open, pussy sores. She quickly asserts herself to show Matheson that she's not to be trifled with. She then responds to his inquiries and monologues that she has hated Arthur since the moment he was born, and that his father killed her father and then forced himself on her mother, and she vowed to kill him and dedicated herself to the dark arts. She recalled that Arthur was a match for her physical traps and Merlin defended against her magic, and is more powerful than she is. In search of greater mystic power, she cast her essence to the winds and found herself on a previously undiscovered 10th planet, where she quickly took over. She eliminated their use of magic and steered them towards science, while absorbing the sorcery of the world for herself. But she did pay a price, which we see in a shot where she sees the start of the sores developing on her back in a reflection. This set her to return home, where she led the aliens to take out the knights, although she planned to save Arthur and Merlin for herself. It's then that she realized that Camelot was gone, but that Arthur has returned, which pleased her and fit her plans to kill him herself. Back in New Camelot, Arthur questions Kay about provoking the knights. Kay points to Gawain and Galahad arm wrestling. Arthur sends Guinevere to find Tristan to make sure that all is okay. Kay tells Arthur that his gift is wit, not bravery or strength, and that his comments have drawn the knights together against him. At this point, Tristan, accompanied by Neoman Percival, approach Merlin, and she makes a request for him to use his magic to return Percival to human and Tristan to being a man. Merlin doesn't even turn around, but merely states, "Be gone." Continued protestations result in once again being told to be gone. Tristan gets to her quarters, where Guinevere is waiting for her. Tristan does not appreciate the attempt to have a girl-to-girl talk and tells her to get out. Meanwhile, Galahad and Gawain continue to arm wrestle at a stalemate. Outside, Lancelot is lurking about, looking for Guinevere, but is met by Tom, who inquires why he would repeat history with Guinevere when he knows it could cause the downfall of New Camelot. And Lancelot talks about how he and Arthur would do anything for each other, but love the same woman, and that's their curse. While this is going on, we see that Tom has a photo of Tristan in her current form in his pocket. Following that conversation, Guinevere meets up with Lancelot, and they have a passionate embrace, which is seen by Arthur. Arthur seeks counsel from Merlin, who advises that what they are doing is not adultery, since Arthur and Guinevere are not actually married. And so Gawain and Galahad, who have both apparently fallen asleep in their stalemate, are awakened by an announcement. And Guinevere and Lancelot's lovemaking session is interrupted by the same announcement to assemble in the throne room. Only Tristan is missing as Arthur announces that there will be a wedding in 2 days. We cut to Kristen's quarters, where there is a mirror, despite orders forbidding them. In the mirror is a reflection of Tristan as a man, standing next to Morgan Le Fay, who promises that she can use her magic to make Tristan a man again, if she betrays the Round Table. Next issue, the Royal Wedding. So this is kind of what we were talking about earlier, about how, you know, it's laying the groundwork, showing how strong they could be, and now showing the cracks in the armor, and showing the potential pitfalls, which I think is just very, very cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and what I really like about this is it shows something that a lot of people don't remember about Arthurian magic, specifically, and that's you have to pay a price. So, like, if you remember in Excalibur, in order for Merlin to change Uther into the semblance of the Duke of Cornwall, he had to then sleep for 9 months, because that was how much power he used. Morgan's getting the same effect, only it's physical. She's got the boils and the sores and everything on her back, because that's her price to pay for... It could be the amount of magic she's using, it could be using this alien source of magic, but you never get away without paying something.
Right. Yeah, that makes total sense, and I do remember that from Excalibur, and I'm looking forward to when we get to do Excalibur on Is It Yours, so everybody stay tuned for that. Hopefully not too long from now.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing about Morgan's story that got me is on page 11, where she's doing her her yoga pose to transport herself somewhere else, all I can think is, ow, my knees. Because she is sitting, sitting on the floor, thighs on the ground, but her feet are touching and they're up at the level of her chest. And I don't bend that way.
Nor would I try.
Yeah, I'd do myself a mischief if I did that. But it's an interesting story that, okay, Morgan, she is not reincarnated. She did not sleep for however many years. To her, it's actually a relatively short period of time. So the transportation to the 10th planet must have taken thousands of years in order for this to line up.
Yeah, well, definitely. But she still concedes that Merlin is more powerful than her. So even with the increase in her power, she's not saying, oh, you know, now he's got to see how, you know, what I'm, you know, what I can do. So she's still, I guess it is a strategic strength that she has in that she's not underestimating her opposition.
Yeah, and she also, she doesn't know the full extent of her power compared to Merlin right now. Because if you remember, the reason that she couldn't beat Merlin before is because Merlin is the son of the devil. in order for Morgan to use her magic, she has to call on the power of the devil. So how can you call on the power of someone who has, and be stronger than their blood relation? Yeah, the connection isn't there. So she actually, at the moment, doesn't know if her 10th planet power is more powerful than Merlin. So she's treating it like they're still where they were. Although she does have one bit of evidence in the second issue when she tried to intercept the knights, the spell Merlin cast to go right. and reawaken the knights. Merlin said, nope, not happening.
Yeah, so we're still seeing that he's, not only is he powerful enough, but he's aware of her.
Yes. Although he hasn't mentioned her.
The fact that he specifically had a interaction with her says that he's aware of her.
Right.
I don't think he thinks that was some unknown power that was trying to stop his reincarnation attempt. I think he knows exactly who did it.
Right, but he hasn't told Arthur. He said that there is a power out there. He didn't tell Arthur anything about it. But speaking of Merlin, I do like his quarters on New Camelot. You go up to the door, and it's like, oh, this is another sci-fi kind of outfit. Nope. You walk inside, and it looks like a 6th century wizard's study, essentially, laboratory. And that's, you would think that Tristan and Percival would go there and say, hey, can you help? We don't like these bodies. Can you do something for us? And Merlin is his normal, compassionate self and says, get the hell out of here.
Yeah, and he's got to be wise enough that he knows that Tristan's going to be targeted.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I guess the thought is, it's up to Tristan to show the integrity to battle that. And it's not for him to save Tristan from it.
Yeah, it's like with your kids, right? Yes, you can do all this stuff for them, but then what do they learn? They have to do it on their own.
Teach them how to fish.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So, yeah, I'm again, my memory is not good as to what happens from here, but I'm looking forward to reading the next two. I really feel like it's ramping up here. And then, I got to say, I can easily step into Arthur or Tom's shoes with the Guinevere-Lancelot relationship. You know that this is not going to end well. And yet, you still do it.
Yeah, but Tom...
Yeah, well, Tom has his own weakness with Tristan.
Yeah.
Which after the conclusion of the issue before, he should be aware that Tristan is not Amber anymore.
Right. And in fact, at the end of the previous issue, he mentally started calling him Tristan, not Amber. But what I find puzzling is, yes, he's got the picture of Tristan, but like you said, it's how Tristan looks now. That's Tristan in the suit he's wearing in this issue. So he knows, by the time that picture was taken, he knows this is a man who is not interested in your relationship. I understand love, you're not thinking straight, but, I mean, how many times does it have a slap in your face that this is not going anywhere?
Yeah, well, you know what? If you ever were what you thought was in love when you were a teenager with somebody who was not interested in you, you can get slapped in the face many, many times and still think, oh, I could turn this around.
Good point. Very good point.
So, it is not a character strength, but it is something that exists out there. I can
it
tell you
human.
From experience. So, I mean, again, I just think this is great. I can't wait to see the next two issues and where we're going to go from there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's every issue was great. but you can tell the overall the story is ramping up, and it's just the soap opera and the action just keeps going up and up every time. So it's gonna be very interesting.
And you know, I mean, the traditional way of telling stories like this. If you look at, I often look to the Star Wars initial trilogy, you know, just for the template for the hero's journey. And,
right.
You know, Empire Strikes Back, we had to see them, you know, the weaknesses that they have. Even though there was a story, you know, there was a story that they triumphed, the triumph was small enough that, you know, they were really in a bad position by the time that ended. You know, you got to build up the stakes and show how, you know, you got to get them to the point where you think, oh, my God, how are they going to survive this? And mm-hmm. then you have to come up with the satisfying ending. So I seem to remember the ending being satisfying. So we will get there when we get there.
Yes.
But right now, I'm gonna once again just say A's across the board. I love this issue. I think this was great.
Yeah, actually, I'm going to say A's across the board, except for the art. The art, I'm giving an A+, because you've got stuff in here with the facial close-ups of the facial expressions, the details and everything, that is just, it's outstanding. You know, it is, you know, the top-of-the-line stuff here, and especially the sores and everything on Morgan. That's just,
Yeah, it does have that feeling. We were looking at a Fantastic Four story with the Thing Hulk retrospective, and there was one that we just recently did where it was when the Thing's face had been messed up by Wolverine, and he was wearing the helmet, and the helmet comes off, and you see it, and his face almost looks like sparkly, it doesn't look like something you'd see and think, oh my God, that's horrible. This looks horrible. This looks disgusting. This looks like if you put your hand on it, you can understand why he was so disgusted by it.
Yes.
And then she shows it with pride. So you know what? In retrospect, I am going to adjust my grade to agree with you. I'm going to say A+ on the art.
All right. I'm glad I could influence you.
Very much so. So that's going to cover our current two issues of Camelot 3000. Be with us in the not-too-distant future when we do issues, 6 and 7?
Yep.
So thanks, Gene, for doing this with me.
Oh, thank you for continuing on with this. This is a fun journey.
And thank you to everybody who's listening. See you next time.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiManzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.